Welcome to another edition of The Spirit Revolution. My name is Philip Cobbins.
My name is Kathleen McGowan.
And our special guest today is Ewan Newman. Now, people in the UK will probably know you best for his yearly extremely good conference called Megalithomania, which he holds annually in the month of May in the lovely town of Glastonbury. But he is also coming to Glastonbury, America, in Connecticut this year, to hold a conference there as well called Megalithomania on the 21st to the 23rd of October. But before we talk about that, you welcome to the show.
Well, thanks for having me on, Philip. I appreciate it a lot.
Now, Kathleen and I, we are and have been obsessed with megaliths for decades. Kathleen, I think, mostly fell in love with them in Ireland, and I fell in love with them in Belgium, the UK, and France. And we recently did a show about Carnac. We did a show actually some months ago when I came back from the Megalithomania conference in Glastonbury, reporting on the highlights there, Howard Crowhurst and all of these people. So, how did you get interested in megaliths?
Well, it was actually really the crop circles, funnily enough, that got me drawn into this whole subject. I was just fascinated by this incredibly odd modern mystery back about 15 or 14 years ago. And I was never really interested in ancient history or history of any sort. All I remembered from school was a list of kings and queens, who won the war, and the Romans, and that kind of bored me somewhat. So the crop circles kind of drew me into the ancient landscape, especially around Wiltshire, and also around my local area, around Wandlebury near Cambridge. I became kind of got quite obsessed by earth energies and ley lines and the energies of these sites and things like this. And that really opened up the door. And then I stumbled across the groundbreaking book, The Son of the Serpent, by Hamish Miller and Paul Broadhurst. And that really, that literally kind of opened up the whole kind of ancestral part of myself into the ancient past and made me realize there's a whole other element to history or prehistory, which is to do with these subtle energies and this much more sort of subtle and interesting and spiritual take on working with these sites. So originally it was really the crop circles that drew me in. I have to admit that.
But from the crop circles, you went on to organizing a conference. You visited all of these places. You continue to visit these places. So where did the shift come from crop circles to megaliths?
Well, it's really to do with the earth energies. It's something I'm still really into, actually, is studying the nature of earth energy lines and how they weave across the landscape and really trying to understand the mystery of their purpose. And obviously, I got into dowsing. You know, you do that when you can visit crop circles and all these ancient sites. And it kind of drew me in, and I realized that obviously there's links with the megalithic sites as well. And then, you know, after a while, after a bit of time spending summers out all these megalithic sites, you officially become a megalithomaniac, and you can't shake it off. And I haven't shaken it off to this day, and it's actually getting stronger. And a lot of people have a serious case of that, where they just, once they get a taste of visiting these ancient sites, wherever they are on the planet, even if it's just a single standing stone in their local area, there's something about them that kind of draws them in and sort of pulls them. It's like a magnetic force that sort of thrills you and sort of pulls you in and makes you interested in what they're all about. And the mystery goes so deep with these sites and so far into the past that I feel there's much more to it and many different ways of approaching, understanding and researching them. And this is something we obviously cover at the conferences, the Megalithomania conferences. We kind of cover all different aspects. We don't, you know, there's no agenda. We don't have a fixed kind of agenda on what we want to have there. We just bring lots of different experts in different fields to come in and share their research, whether they're academic or whether they're extremely cosmic, far-out theories. We're interested in all of it because it's the only way you can get a true, holistic understanding of the greater megalithic picture.
And what is the emerging picture? Because, as you say, you have people like Howard Crowhurst who are very detailed in their mathematical approach to it, who've identified extreme accuracy, mathematical precision in their megalithic monuments. You have also people, as you say, who speak more about the energetic qualities of it. You have various other people who speak about the folklore aspect, people who will just do presentations about new megaliths, which they've uncovered somewhere. So to me, the megaliths has always been this civilization in largely Western Europe, which science and archaeology and history has always neglected, which in recent years has got something of a revival within that field. But, you know, like megalithomania or megaliths, it's like big stones. It's an interest in big stones. And it almost seems as if that's the only thing science or history is willing to tell about it, and that's the only thing they know about it. So where are we? You bring all of these people together, you read all of this research, you've been involved in this field for a while. What are your conclusions? What is emerging? What are these big stones?
That's a fine question. Well, to me, you know, from my personal perspective and what, you know, we represent at the conference, there really does seem to be like a sort of megalithic renaissance happening where people are realizing there's something much deeper. I mean, like you said, you can study all these sites from different, you know, different angles. From, you can go into the very mathematical scientific life, such as Howard Crowhurst and Robin Heath and others. You can go much more into the intuitive side where people are dowsing and feeling the energies there. And there's, you know, there's many theories you can attach to them because we don't really know. However, the interest in these sites, just from lay people, just from, you know, the general public, really get an interest in visiting these sites. And this is proven in the statistics, actually, of the amount of people who visit them all over the world. They're increasing hugely. It suggests that there's something about our past that within ourselves we're searching for. And I believe we've lost, you know, as a culture and as a world culture, really, we've been cut off from our ancestors. We've been cut off from our prehistoric past, and everything's modern, everything's now. And they don't really teach you, like you said, they don't really teach you the proper history anymore. And so people are yearning for their ancestors, yearning for their prehistoric selves. And I think one of the only ways they can connect is to actually go and visit the sites themselves, which are actually the places that their ancestors built, and where they lived, where they did ceremony. And actually they might be able to tune into something which the history books don't really cover. And they might be able to kind of have more of a shamanic experience or more of a spiritual experience, and actually connect with that deeper part of themselves.
And is that something which people are doing today, or people who are researching this aspect of megaliths, which they are tapping into?
Yeah, I think there's been a lot of research done. It's kind of more speculative, but, you know, the psychic research that's done at sites, the you know, people are tuning in, you know, at these sites and sort of picking up, you know, what they think might have been programmed into the sites in prehistory. There's lots of different groups who do that. None of them, you know, particularly taken seriously because of the nature of that and the way academia frowns upon that kind of thing. But I think it's not really about that as research. It's more about that as a personal thing, as a more, you know, a more spiritual kind of connection that people, you know, need, really. I think these ancient sites kind of give that kind of energy, can give that kind of element to individuals rather than, you know, approaching it as a researcher or a scientist or anything like that. So I think this is why these sites are so enthralling for so many different people, because you have that side of it, the more personal connection of people searching for something within them. Plus you have the amazingness of these sites, the sheer magnitude and geometry and mathematics and the grids and ley lines and all things like that. And people are just fascinated by that deeper mystery about why they were built and how they were built and who on earth did them. And so I think there's an enthralling mystery that still surrounds them and is unlikely to be, likely to be revealed in our lifetimes, if ever. I think they were designed with that kind of mystery in mind.
So when you say that they are there to connect with the ancestors, the shamanic way, obviously they were built by a people. When do you think they were built, and with which ancestors were they there to connect for? Or was it like, were they built for a purpose and then were their descendants connecting with the people who built them? How do you see this working?
Well, I see that. That's a very interesting point because, I mean, first of all, one of the interesting aspects of these sites, which a lot of people, a lot of your listeners might not realise, is the sheer length of time between when the first sort of stone circles or megalithic sites were built in Europe and when the last ones were built, really. Well, even then, they're still being built today, to be honest with you. Modern megalithic sites are still under construction. But you've got to go back to, you know, some areas of Europe, Ireland, possibly Ireland. There's some dates that sort of stretching back to 5000 BC and beyond. In Brittany, you get extremely ancient dates, carbon dating of some of the sites. And obviously now you have Göbekli Tepe in southern Turkey, which goes back to 10,000 years ago at least. And so you've got to realize that sites are being built up to about 1000 BC, maybe even 500 BC. So there's a huge period of time. We're looking at 3,000 or 4,000 years of megalithic construction. So it's like 2000 BC to the present day would be the megalithic era if we brought it forward a bit. So do you understand? You know, this is a huge amount of time we're dealing with here. So even the people who are building megalithic sites in the Bronze Age were probably harking back to the golden age of the Neolithic when they were being built then. So I think people, you know, have got to understand that first and foremost, the sheer magnitude of time we're dealing with here. And so obviously it was very important to them to build these sites for a very long time. I mean, I think one of the most interesting examples of this is Stonehenge, because in the car park at Stonehenge, you might notice three big blobs of paint on the floor in the car park, on the ground there. And they are actually megalithic kind of wooden post holes that were dated to at least 10,000 years old. And they were aligned east-west, like equinox alignment. They were huge tree trunk-like posts, three of them in a row. So someone marked that site 10,000 or 11,000 years ago, and it was only like 6,000 or 6,500 years after that that the first part of what we know as Stonehenge started to be built, the henge there. And then it took another 1,500 years to complete it and going through all these different changes. So this is the sort of thing we're dealing with here. And apparently people didn't even live as long as we live today. So in their short lifetimes, they were sharing this knowledge, they were teaching it and continuing it through the generations very carefully. And I think there's something, you know, they had a whole different outlook towards how to approach what these sites meant and what they would mean for future generations. And I think a lot of it is there's an element of compassion involved there, where they were building them deliberately to teach the future generations and for them to be used by the future generations. Whereas we don't really do that today in architecture. It's not like that. It's about money and convenience, really. Doesn't really have that kind of quality of that the ancients were kind of working with. So I just get that, you know, when you're dealing with these different stages of time, from the Neolithic to the Bronze Age, and the Bronze Age to the Iron Age, and up to the present day, yes, I think they were being built for future generations. So it's almost like the way we're looking back through the generations to reach these eras. They were looking forward as such, and putting the connection into the future. So yeah, I think these are perhaps these are the ways you can look at that.
You talked about this sort of vast expanse of time that we have. I want to talk for a minute about this vast expanse of space. So when we're looking at, say, what are arguably some of the oldest, if not the oldest, in Turkey, for example, Göbekli Tepe, and then we move west, and then we're in Brittany, and then we move further west, and then we're in the islands. We're in Ireland. We're in Great Britain. So what do you think is the relationship between these megalith builders that have spanned Europe from east to west? Are we looking at a migration? Are we looking at one great culture that migrates and takes this wisdom and knowledge with them? What do you think is the relationship between these places and the people who built them?
That's another good question. If we start at Göbekli Tepe, for instance, this is something that people such as Andrew Collins and others have been looking at. That's like an anomaly, really. It's really bizarre. It's almost like it was deliberately covered up after it was finished with. They carbon dated it. They've got the dates back to, you know, over 10,000 years ago. Oddly, I mean, my research leads me back to the western parts of Ireland, really, as the sort of oldest and the origins of sort of megalithic civilization. It seems to always seem to refer back to Ireland. I don't know why, it just does. It's something that Michael Sarrion has come up with in his research as well, and many other people who've looked into this. So Göbekli Tepe is like an anomaly, really. It's almost like shouldn't be there. And you get certain other sites around the world with extreme dates, which don't really make sense. But then you get, you know, the post holes in Stonehenge, which are the same kind of era as Göbekli Tepe. I think some of the earlier sites in Ireland go back to that kind of era as well, and possibly some of the sites in Britain, because, you know, the dating of certain sites is a tough one to do, and there's lots of debates about the different techniques and nowadays and sort of arguments about that. And so we really don't know. I think the paradigm is shifting with how we look at these sites and how the cultures moved around, whether they were diffusing around the world or whether it was a great culture like we have today. We have like constant communication between all parts of the world. Maybe it was like that then. Maybe I believe they sailed a lot between all around the Mediterranean, up the Iberian coast into Europe, and right over even around Africa and pretty much all over the world. I think they had a high understanding, because some of the maps kind of prove this as well. Obviously, when you look at the Piri's Res map and the various other ones that have been put together and by various researchers such as Charles Hapgood and others, when they've analysed them and sort of tried to reflect a date back to when they could have been created, we're looking at, you know, the world was fully mapped several thousand years BC. No one's sure exactly when. Some suggest even 10,000 years BC because of the Antarctica region that was supposedly covered with ice then. But on some of these maps, it's actually free of ice, and the terrain and landscape has been mapped. So it brings up a lot of questions about how old, you know, the sophisticated civilizations do go back. And this is obviously something that people like Graham Hancock have popularized. But I believe there's something that's sort of missing, and there's some research and there's stuff that's still to come out, I think, which is going to probably give us some more answers to that, probably over the next few years. Well, when you look at Göbekli Tepe as an example we're referring back to here, it was accidentally found just under a deliberately covered up site. And that date is, you know, that is that old, and it's in almost perfect condition, some of it. And so you think, well, what else has been covered up? I mean, if we are going back this far, if we are stretching back 10,000 BC and beyond, then it's going to be quite a lot of places are going to be fully buried, even to this day. And so we have to consider that when we're looking at these sites. I mean, look at some of the statues on Easter Island. They were buried kind of up to their chest. But when they uncovered some of them, there was a full body there, which was, you know, another 20 feet below the ground. And you get this around Callanish and the Orkneys and places like that. You get build up, you know, some sites get virtually covered up. So, I think there's a lot more to be found. Yeah. And I think a lot of them have just been built upon by towns and cities. And there's probably a whole lot of stuff going on under the ground that is yet to be discovered. I don't know exactly where or what sites these would be. But this is where it kind of gets interesting.
Absolutely. And as you said, there are like megaliths across pretty much the world. They're in Holland, they are in Belgium, they're in France. But it's specifically, I think, certain parts of the United Kingdom, western parts of Scotland, Ireland as a whole, and Brittany, where really there is a strong cultural link with the megaliths. It's like almost as if those nations have defined themselves among and with the megaliths. So there's a lot of folklore attached to it. To that, how do you perceive this folklore with the megaliths? Because again, historians will kind of tell and say that the folklore to do with the megaliths has got nothing to do with the archaeological study of the megaliths themselves. What's your perspective on that?
Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, the folklore is especially strong in Britain. I know that for a start, and parts of Europe, Brittany, as you said. I've been looking into the folklore around Britain and collecting data on it to do with a project I've been researching, this fertility aspect of these sites, whether there's scientifically verified or not. But there's yeah, I mean, the more you look into the folklore, the more you find clues that are now being backed up by science. And this is what really, really interests me, because I'll give you an example to do with this fertility research. There's the work of John Burke and Kaj Halberg and Philip Callahan and a few others who have been doing tests at sacred sites on energies there and found that when seeds are placed there, it would fertilize and strengthen the seed, so it would grow much quicker, get 3 or 4 times more yield even, be frost resistant and be more abundant crops. And so that is fertility in action, yeah? And then you look at the folklore of these sites and they all talk about fertility. I have about 100 examples of sites around Britain in my database of this in action that go back to, you know, several hundred years, possibly 1,000 years. And they were probably passed on before that through generations of families from, you know, when these sites were being used thousands of years ago. And amazingly, these sites still work as these fertility or energy generators. So there's a lot to be said for folklore when you realize that, you know, eventually science catches up with it. And to do with healing energies of these stones, to do with like giants even moving the stones is, I know this sounds might sound quite weird to some listeners, but there's a lot of evidence of a giant culture all across the world, in different parts of the world, at different eras, of these very tall beings who are extremely powerful and intelligent and were possibly linked with the megalithic sites and the pyramid sites in various parts of the planet. So you keep looking at this folklore, and you kind of, a lot of people just, you know, the academics especially, they kind of just brush it off as like silly kind of, you know, folk tales of, you know, of peasants in the area, local peasants and things like that. But I think there's a lot more to them than meets the eye, and folklore and legends of particular sites and areas should be, you know, accounted for and taken more seriously.
Absolutely. And that's kind of like what Kathleen specifically in all her work is underlining as well, the fact that there is so much more than, you know, just a written down word. Now, slightly sidestepping, but I think still on the same subject, is that in recent months, in like the last year, I specifically have become very fascinated with those specific stones who have faces in them, who kind of, you know, as if the stone was chosen because they reveal a face, sometimes quite human-like, sometimes more animal-like, sometimes just, I would say, an imaginary creature. And then in the, actually, before, just the day before coming to the Megalithomania conference in May, I visited Avebury and began to photograph all the stones there. And pretty much every one of them had a face kind of aspect, sometimes, you know, even 2-3 faces on one stone. Have you been ever looking into that? I know Paul Devereux, about more than a decade ago, tried to get people aware of that. But when you talk about these giants, it almost seems as if, you know, this tradition of like how it was, you know, the medieval tradition of how it was a Roman army which was petrified, or how it was the Druids, all of these things, this connection between the stones and man, and then the faces which we see in them, is very strong. And I'm just wondering whether you have opinions, ideas, or conclusions about it.
Well, yeah, I mean, this is, I was just in Avebury a couple of nights ago, actually, and we were out there in the nighttime, and I was just hanging out around one of the stones of the northern smaller stone circle, which would have only about 3 stones left in it now. And clearly, it seemed like when we were sitting against it, we were sitting under a big nose hovering right above us. So, yeah, I think Avebury is a really good example of that. I think Terence Meaden's done a whole book about that, looking at the different simulacra in the stones there. But yeah, I mean, whether they're natural or they were chosen because they looked like that, or whether that's just the way the stones are and the designers didn't even think of that, or whether they were shaped and cut, I mean, this is one of the mysteries. There's also a place called Markahazy in Peru, which has, again, it's got lots of what looks like, you know, anthropomorphic figures and animals and faces all over it. So it's something that intrigues me. Yeah, I think this it's almost like the spirit of the landscape or the elemental spirit of the rocks, and even, you know, potentially the ancestors maybe their way of communicating was by helping nature shape itself. But yeah, no, I'm particularly interested in that. And the more you the more you have keep an eye out for that, the more you seem to find and get attracted to them. So, but I think Avebury is probably the most fascinating place to kind of gaze at the stones and find amazing faces in them.
Absolutely. Which kind of brings me to a pop question. If you've seen so many sites, you've visited so many sites, if you were to pick your top three of sites where people had to go to, or which you just feel are the best sites, which one would it be, and also why specifically those?
Okay. Okay. God, I mean, I could probably list a top 50 better than a top three. But yeah, I mean, obviously the sites in Britain are particularly interesting to me. Avebury, I think, is as the cutting edge for me in Britain because of you can spend days there exploring and the landscape and the avenues and the sanctuary, West Kennet, Longbarrow, Silbury Hill, even the Devil's Den, which not many people get to, the sort of what's left of an old Longbarrow there. It just looks like a dolmen nowadays. That is a particularly beautiful and amazing landscape. It's just a real pity they built a village and a pub inside the middle of Avebury. But yeah, that is, I highly recommend that. And it's the sort of place you can go and you can relax there. It's not like Stonehenge where you get ushered around and you've got like half an hour and then you can't even touch the stones, unfortunately. But obviously Stonehenge is up there. It's a very unique stone circle, Stonehenge. There's nothing else like it in England or Britain, really, where the stones have been shaped so perfectly and cut like they are in Egypt or Peru. They're beautifully carved into this wonderful circular temple. But there's many other sites. I mean, there are like probably 900 remaining stone circles, apparently, in Britain. And that doesn't include single standing stones, the avenues, the dolmens, the long barrows, or anything else. It's just stone circles. So we're looking probably at 10,000 or more, probably, in the whole of Britain. Which ones you want to go to? I mean, it really is a case of go to as many as possible and feel into what resonates with you, I think. Some other sites around the world that I've got a particular attraction to are Tikal in Guatemala. I've been there twice now, and I had a very powerful experience when I was there about 8 or 9 years ago. A full-on past life experience with three other people I met, and I literally couldn't leave there for about a week. And I set up my hammock in the forest there and didn't leave. The sites in North America really intrigue me, to be honest with you. I'm fascinated by the mound culture sites all along the Mississippi, which I'm going to visit partly later in a couple of months, and I'm going to do a little tour there next year. And also the New England sites up in New York State, Les Balanced Rock. Very powerful site that is, very, very beautiful, amazing dolmen. And also up in Connecticut and Massachusetts, you have places like Gungeewomp, and obviously America's Stonehenge, Mystery Hill up in New Hampshire, which is surprising. I mean, the thing that kind of gets me about these places in North America is that you don't really expect them to be there. And so it kind of gives that this real element of like wow factor, because, well, what are they doing here? No one, you know, it's not really popularized in America as such that there are these kind of places. But obviously there's a whole world of ancient sites and megaliths. This is what really blows my mind, that you get some megalithic sites, you know, some megalithic construction styles, such as dolmens, for instance, which is like a table, like two or three stones with an upright stone on top. They are everywhere. Almost every ancient culture on the planet has them. They're all over the world, equally spread everywhere. And this is really bizarre, because this comes back to an earlier question about diffusionism, where it seems like the dolmen was the sort of was a style that was used for about 3,000 years in different parts of the world, and some reason they kept using it. And dolmen is also very useful for harnessing and controlling these fertility natural earth energies. And so it seems like it was almost like a technology, like information and technology, which was being shared around the world. And so, you know, I'm very keen on, you know, trying to pick out three of my favorite sites. I've kind of covered that, but I'm very keen on people go to visit their local sites. I think that's one of the most important things people can do, is actually visit the one that's closest or within a few miles of where they live, because often you don't do that when you've moved somewhere. You think, oh, I can see that anytime, and then you don't actually get around to going to see it. And so I think that's really important, to connect with your local area and the sites there, because often they can have quite a profound effect on you, and you don't realize until you get there how important that sometimes can be.
Absolutely. And as you said, there are like 10,000 structures of this kind just in Britain alone. They are, you know, just around where I, where we live in the UK, there is one anywhere you want to drive to, you will pass one along the road. And very few people know about them, and even fewer people are actually interested in them. So it, you've been saying it's like it's forgotten. In some parts, it's still connected. Where does science stand on this? Where is, you know, like, are they trying to preserve it? Are they still not interested? Are there people who you know of who are trying to come up with answers? Or is it pretty much a hands-off policy of we don't know?
Yeah, I mean, I think if we, I mean, obviously you get the sites in Britain that, you know, are kind of looked after, they're controlled by English Heritage and things like this. And so obviously they're preserved. But, you know, sometimes sites actually do get damaged if too many people visit them. But when you're looking at the sites in New England and America, for instance, there's a lot of problems there because many of the sites are recognised and they become tourist attractions, like America's Stonehenge, Mystery Hill, for instance. Gungeewomp's looked after by the Gungeewomp Society now. And you get the New England Antiquities Research Association, NERA, who actually look after the sites and protect them and educate people about them. And they're part of, they're involved in our project, our conference over in America as well, and that they're helping us with the tours and things like that. But what you get in New England, for instance, which I find particularly baffling and upsetting in a way, is that the archaeologists and a lot of the historians don't recognise these megalithic chambers you get there, these sort of prehistoric chambers, as ancient sites. They're referred to as colonial root cellars, where the first settlers built them so they would actually just put their vegetables in to store them, which I don't think that the first settlers would use 25-ton megalithic blocks to store their potatoes and construct it and build it into a hillside on a specific magnetic anomaly in a very powerful area just to preserve potatoes. I think it was like there was a whole other dimensional quality and much earlier culture who are involved in this. And even it's known now that many of the dolmens and the chambers in New England were adopted by the Native Americans, and they didn't even know who built them. Many of them were part of this earlier culture, which people really don't know who they were, but there are some clues coming forth about that, and coming over from Ireland even, which is where a lot of the clues seem to refer back to, in, you know, several thousand BC perhaps. So you do get this problem where, because the archaeologists and historians don't recognise the sites as ancient and as important, they just see them as colonial root cellars, often these road widening schemes and construction projects actually allow them to be destroyed. Completely destroyed sometimes, and there's nothing anyone can do about them because there's so much money involved and so much at stake that it's really hard to stop the process once things, you know, contracts have been signed. So many of them have been lost, but fortunately NERA do a lot of work to protect them, and there's another group called KEPRI who are based in the area as well, and also a lot of them are on private land. And when, you know, the private landowners are notified by NERA, you know, to, this is a sacred site, ancient site, you've got to protect it, let us know if there's anything going to happen to it, and they actually keep an eye on it through the private landowners. So there is some good coming out of them actually being on private land. But a lot of them are still being destroyed, and you get this a lot in New England at the moment. This is something that a guy called Dan Budillion, who works with NERA in around the Boston area, was telling me about when I was there a few years ago, and he was doing his utmost to kind of put the word out and protect them. And obviously, you even get the whole Tara story in Ireland, don't you? I mean, just from a couple of years ago, where, you know, just known ancient landscapes and sites like that, that are definitely prehistoric, definitely important, were still going to be destroyed just so people can make a fast buck, you know. And so, yeah, we have to kind of stay on top of the game here and encourage the authorities to put more protection up to keep these sites safe.
I'm an Irish girl, so and I come from a family. Actually, come from a family of pagans, which is an unusual thing in Ireland. My family, my mother's side, is from Sligo, so I'm very connected to the powerful megalithic sites in the west of Ireland. But also this issue with what happened at the Hill of Tara over the last couple of years has been absolutely devastating for so many of us. And just this idea that people are willing to destroy and throw away these incredibly important, you know, these are jewels of our humanity. And I, you know, there needs to be more education. People need to understand that we can't allow these priceless treasures on our planet to be destroyed, like you said, for a fast buck, so people can, you know, drive to Dublin faster.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, we the Celtic Tiger devoured so much of the soul of Ireland over those years, and what happened at Tara was, I think, sort of the most egregious of the crimes, culturally and spiritually. So, you know, I think one of the things I struggle with is how do we make people more aware in a broader way? I mean, what you're doing with your conference is fantastic, and I think that is a very big first step. But for people like me who, you know, I write books, what would you say, based on everything that you're observing, what do you think is a good next step to continue to get the word out there, to make people understand that we really have to protect these sites and that they really are precious and important for all of us?
Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah, I mean, I think, I mean, one of the things which seems to be happening is it's interesting that the scientists, like I said earlier, are catching up with what people have said all along to do with the folklore and to do with the energies of these sites. And so what they're realizing is that they're actually like a technology. They're actually like, actually produced this energy which was being used by the ancients. And they were obviously built by the ancients to last, so this energy could be used, you know, forever, potentially. And so there's something about that, I think, which is, and I think if that gets developed, and these theories and these this scientific kind of data, it's going to make people think again that they're actually messing up a natural energy generator, a sort of almost like a spiritual energy generator of their part of that, you know. And it could affect the whole landscape. We're not just talking about affecting a small area. I mean, one example of this, I think, which would be great if this gets into the mass consciousness, like you're suggesting, is that some tests were done in Australia and on this farm, on several. The farms in Australia are huge, hundreds of miles sometimes, and they put lots of little stone circles. This is in the modern era, a few, you know, 10, 15 years ago. Lots of stone circles, maybe a couple of feet, 3 feet wide, with about 6 or 7 little stones in them, basalt and things like that. Put them all over the farm because the geomancers were sensing, you know, we should do this because it'll increase the energy of all the crops and enhance the crops. And it did do that. Within a year, all the crops were growing better and faster. They were more healthy. There was less bugs. There was less problems. Even the soil got enriched, and all the energy systems of the whole farm became enriched, and it was like it's almost like an enchantment of that landscape. And so if you're looking at that, you're looking at the same principles but on a much larger scale, where you've got these massive megalithic stone circles and sites all across the country and the world. They were working with there was the same principle at work as they discovered on these farms in Australia, where they you know, it's obviously these great energy lines that go between these sites. There was a massive network of enchantment and sort of charged energy across the entire landscape of countries, which created this kind of enchantment and this sort of spiritual kind of magical energy, which kept us all on a sort of higher frequency, a higher level of consciousness. And I think when people, you know, as we're sort of, you know, moving towards 2012 and there seems to be this sort of gradual consciousness shift unfolding, it's almost like that people are realizing what these sites over the landscape were kind of for. So, this, you know, I think that is, I mean, one aspect that I think is, could become quite popular and could enhance and maybe give another element to these sites. Obviously, a lot of the academics will take a bit longer for them to come around to it, like it always does. But I think there's something, you know, when people realize that, you know, you have to look after the site. So the whole global or the whole country maintains that level of enchantment, and the more you destroy them, the less, you know, the less it works as such. But I don't know if that's probably a bit too far out for to happen on a global scale. I don't know, but I kind of like that idea, and I think that's something that that could become quite popular.
Let's definitely hope so. And I kind of was fascinated by the fact that, you know, it actually, as you're saying, fields where megaliths are present have a higher yield ratio than those which haven't. And so much destruction of megalithic sites happened because farmers were removing them from their fields around Avebury in Carnac. And it just shows you, once again, this industrial revolution. It was all logic, but very little heart and very little understanding. So one thing which I kind of want to go back to and add on to is the fact that so many sites, when they were identified as of being interest and of importance, like Stonehenge, Howard Crowhurst in Brittany, they're identifying that so many of these sites have astronomical alignments to events like the summer solstice or the spring equinox, the winter solstice, or things to do with the moon. So where does this, in your opinion, feature into? Because Gerald Hawkins was one of those people who basically went the other way and said, like, oh, these our ancestors almost didn't seem to be unaware of the specific times and the specific events with the calendar, so they needed these gigantic systems to find out which date it was. But that seems to be specifically overkill, I think, specifically from a farming community. And people have come away with that. John North has moved more into the how this is part of their religion. So where are we with this stellar component to the megaliths?
Well, I think people are quickly realising, especially with people like Robin Heath, Howard Crowhurst, and John Michel and Alexander Thom, that there was there was a high level science and sophistication and astronomical kind of knowledge built into these sites, and the geodetic location of them as well in relation. I mean, they were choosing certain latitudes where they could only function as astronomical calendars at certain latitudes, at certain positions on the planet. And so there's no way it was just all religious, all kind of simple, kind of, you know, basic, you know, that kind of thing. There was a whole other scientific element to it, I think, which we're coming around to realize. I believe there was probably an elite who had a high understanding and maintained this knowledge, from different cultures, and this was then shared through the different generations, through the mystery schools and things like this. I really believe there is kind of two ways to look at it, because, you know, when you look at these sites from a modern perspective, you see that there's all these different elements built into one site. There's not just the maths, the geometry, the sort of astronomical alignments. There's all the intuitive, the magical energy, the sort of more spiritual side to it as well. But I think we have to, you know, all we can do is approach it from the angles that that each of us individually specialize in and see what we come up with. But I really think that, you know, if they were enhancing their seeds and they were growing crops, you have to have a good calendar. I mean, you have to. I mean, you can't just guess when the frost is going to come. You can't guess when the time of year has arrived. You have to be watching the skies. And I think you need to have some kind of system in place which you can keep, you know, recalibrating and retuning the calendar to. And building it in stone is the obvious way to do it, which will last for many thousands of years, so it can be done by future generations as well. And I really think we're just, you know, in our generation, we're just coming around to, you know, realize what the ancients were really doing and what they were capable of.
Absolutely. And I think that's kind of like the common denominator, is that when you start looking into the past, you find it is far more rich than anything you kind of read in the history books. And there is this drive. Now, this drive, you've mentioned his name, John Michel. I believe he was a co-founder with you of Megalithomania Conference. He passed away last year, I think. He is very much present at each conference still. Give us an overview of this man who's quite well known in Britain, but in America far less so. So who was John Michel?
John Michel was basically, he was like the Earth Mysteries kind of pioneer. He kind of cracked so many things we take for granted in the Earth Mysteries world and the megalithic world and, you know, ley lines and all this kind of stuff. He was the first person to really talk about most of them. He was the inspiration for a lot of things, and he basically brought back this the idea of ley lines has pretty much died out from earlier last century with Alfred Watkins. It died out in the 40s pretty much, and he brought it back into the popular consciousness in the 1960s, late 60s. He wrote a book called The Flying Saucer Vision, and then his classic and his sort of pretty much his best book, even though they're all amazing, The View Over Atlantis, where he came up with the whole St. Michael line thing. He was the first person to really talk about the fertility rites and folklore and relate them to the sites. There were these currents moving through the earth. He cracked some of the geometries to do with Stonehenge and the ancient metrology. He kind of inspired people like John Neal and others who became expert ancient metrologists to actually start doing their work. He was doing work on many different angles of the liberal arts, really looking at geometry, mathematics, ratios, and looking at the relationship of the moon to the earth. And he really was a pioneer, if not the most important kind of person, I believe, who kind of unlocked many of the different classic kind of themes within the earth mysteries field. He passed away in 2009 on St. George's Day, I believe, interestingly, and we dedicated that particular conference to him. And every year now we have Christine Roan, who's a former co-author best friend of his, who has founded the sort of John Michel Society, and she gets people who are associated with John to come in and do talks every year, you know, sort of looking at certain aspects of his work and how it's developed since then. But yeah, he was a big inspiration for me personally as well, and for John Martin, who was one of the other founders. I really recommend people read The View Over Atlantis if they haven't read it yet. It's one of those classics. And obviously he's done books about the geometry of Jerusalem, and how it links to other places around the way. He did a brilliant book about the ancient stones of Land's End, which is a kind of classic, really hard to get hold of. And his last book was called How the World Was Made. And that was a beautiful piece of work with a lot of his own art in it, looking at creation myths in relationship to sacred geometry, which is a masterful piece of work and a sort of swan song for him to go out on. It's absolutely superb.
Yes, he was a remarkable man. I met him only on very brief occasions, quite often in the Georgian Pilgrim in Glastonbury. It seemed to be his office. But he was a remarkable man, and as you say, he was a person who put this all back on the map. Now you're carrying it out across the world very much. Very much from just quote unquote organizing a conference. You're doing an awful lot of travels. You're organizing one conference in Connecticut in a few weeks. So tell us a bit about what you have been doing and what you're doing for the future, and also why you're doing it. Why are you, traveling the world and taking people with you rather than just doing your own research?
It was a natural progression, really. We've been doing this conference in Glastonbury for 6 or 7 years now, and it became very popular. It was everyone was having a great time. We always do tours to all the sites, to Stonehenge. We get private access and to like Dartmoor, Stanton Drew and other places, and Dorset, and we visit many sites three or so days after the conference. All the different experts and authors come on the tours as well and give their interpretations. And the next one we're doing in England is in Glastonbury, Somerset, on the 12th and 13th of May, for people to put in their diary, 2012. And earlier this year we got invited over to South Africa with Michael Tellinger to do a conference there in March, and Johannesburg, and it was wonderful. And he's obviously, there's lots of sites he's discovered down that way as well, in that part of South Africa. And so we're doing stuff there now every year. And then our good friend Jason Matozo, who's another megalithomaniac, he invited us over to do a conference over in Connecticut, in Glastonbury, Connecticut, funnily enough. We're doing it there on the 21st to 23rd of October, and people can. It's best if people check out the megalithamerica.com website. It's one word, megalithamerica.com. They can find out all the info there. It's also on megalithomania.co.uk as well. And we just, there's lots of ancient sites in that area, the New England sites. So it's an excuse and an opportunity to really go exploring them, but also to take groups out, with NERA and with Gunji Warp Society, to actually go there, and actually look at these sites, which are really hard to explore, really, if you go in there on your own, but in a group, we can arrange things and get people out to many of these particular sites. We're doing 3 days of tours over there after the conference. And then we do large sort of international tours to, places like Egypt and Peru and things like that. We've got one coming up to Peru and Bolivia with Brian Forrester and David Hatch Childress. in November. That's pretty much full now, but we've got more planned. It's just this thing of like, you know, I want to go to the sites. Yeah, all the people who come to the conference, they don't want to just come to a conference and sit on a chair for 2 or 3 days. They want to get out on the landscape, and they want to go with people who've done the research, like David Childress, for instance, or Robert Bouval in Egypt, and actually have an experience, actually feel into the sites, you know, feel the energies there rather than just hear about them in books or at a conference. So yeah, we're kind of just trying to spread it out really. And it's just through demand really, we were doing all this and through natural, it's like a natural progression to get as far and wide as possible and get to as many of these sites as we can with as many people who'd like to come. And you know, it's very exciting because you often the people who come on the tours or to the conference have a lot to offer, and actually we learn as well as we go along from their experiences and their research. So it becomes a very kind of synchronistic kind of beautiful way of doing it.
Absolutely. And just, you know, from personal experience, I've spoken at the Megalithomania conference, it's one of the few conferences I actually go to as a member of the audience, because it is great. And as you say, it's not just sitting on your bum and listening. You can also experience the sites there nearby, and you also have a quite diverse perspective on things, like, you know, people like John Major Jenkins, who I think you also have in Glastonbury, Connecticut, are not necessarily directly associated with what you would think of megalithic culture, but they are definitely linked with it. And at the end of the, you know, the 2-3 days of events, you kind of come away with a homogeneous picture, which isn't just a PowerPoint presentation, but it's also something which you can experience in the nearby landscape. So it's this traveling and sitting down thing, which is far more all-inclusive than just a standard format. So where do you see the future? What is your hope? What is your ambition? What would you like to see happen? What do you think is most necessary to happen?
I just feel it's just like I said earlier, it's like a case of people, you know, reconnecting with the sites, you know, experiencing them, exploring them, researching them, and let's try and crack this mystery. There's a lot of people out there. Once you get the bug of megalithomania, once you get a taste of these sites, it's really hard to sort of turn back. And you know, I've got the rest of my life planned out, traveling and exploring and doing conferences and writing books. You know, it's kind of taken over my life. But I'm more than happy. I love getting out to these places, and magic happens. Often when you go in groups, it happens especially. So, you know, I get excited by the idea of taking, you know, going out there with groups and seeing what takes place. But I really feel, I don't think there's any real kind of goal with it or real agenda with it. We're just doing it because we love it. And we just, you know, we're called to it. It's like the sites are calling us to get to, they want people there for some reason. They want to have human energy, people who are kind of, you know, go there with a positive attitude. You know, an inquisitive mind. It's almost like they're magnetizing us to them themselves. It's like they want us to be there. It's not just us wanting to go. It's kind of like interaction going on, and there's something about that which I think is to do with our ancestors and the people who built them, the intention they put into them. But I also get a sense that it helps people to know that there is the sacred on the planet. Because people, you know, are quite disillusioned, I believe, now with, you know, organized religion, and they actually want to experience something themselves. And often you can just feel the energies of these sites and have an experience. It could be quite powerful. And so I think people have a calling for that. And, you know, but people, everyone wants to travel. Everyone wants to see the world. It's just, you know, we have to do it. And I've got the bug. I can't stop, you know. So I'm just sort of very pleased my life has personally has taken that particular path.
So you have become a megalithomaniac because you cannot go anywhere except to other megaliths. And we have come to the end of our show, so we need to go elsewhere as well. If you enjoyed listening to you, you can see him if you are in the Connecticut area or can get there by the 21st of October in Glastonbury, Connecticut at the Megalithomania America Conference. You can listen again to our show on the BBS Radio Archives. You can go to iTunes. You can go to thespiritrevolution.com, where you are able to listen to the five last shows for free. iTunes is, of course, free, and you have to pay a fee for the BBS Radio Archives, where you just not get access to our shows, but all the shows which are aired on BBS Radio. So until next time, from the both of us,
the truth against the world.